First of all, we need to come back to GR and come back to standard cosmology. That's what I'm going to talk about in this talk. So thank you for having me here. I'm Xinyu. Just a very quick intro. From the gravitational wave signal we receive, we can directly measure the luminosity distance to the gravitational wave source, since it goes inversely as the amplitude of the signal. Of course, there are other parameters that can also modify your amplitude, such as their mass, their sky location, the binary orientation, but some of the parameters can be also determined from other parts of the waveforms, for example, the mass, while some other parameters you will need to marginalize it out if you don't have further information. But let's say now we have the luminosity distance measurement to the gravitational wave source, then from standard cosmology we can relate the luminosity distance to astrophysical source to the redshift that's due to the universe expansion. There's a contribution from the universe expansion through this equation, which is described by a set of cosmological parameters including H naught, omega matter, omega lambda. So let's say if we now have a gravitational wave source with the distance measurement, what's left to be determined is the redshift here. And especially for the LIGO sources, since we are relatively nearby for most of the sources, so V is relatively small here, and that's why the best determining parameters will be H0, and that's going to be the majority of my talk. Okay, so there are different methods has been proposed for how we do cosmology with gravitational waves, depending on how much information you have. For example, you might capture the EM counterpart, you might not. That will allow you to determine the redshift, or maybe you have no redshift at all. But since I only have 20 minutes, so I'll go directly to the most promising method, which is the case we have a unique identification of the redshift. So that is the idea that's already 30 years old, that that's first raised by Bernice Hughes. So, or you all heard of this name, Sander Siren, which means, let's say if we have a gravitational wave source that's captured by LIGO, and that source lies within certain galaxies, and let's say the source also emits light and captured by the telescope, then the EM counterpart will help us to identify the host galaxy, or say host cluster, that will give us a redshift of the gravitational wave sources. So with both redshift and luminosity distance, we can do cosmology. And that this method has already been realized for the first time for OA17 detection, which we measure the distance to be 40 megaparsec, and we also capture the redshift for NGC4993. So there is the first H0 measurement from the gravitational wave. And as you can see, the uncertainty of H0 is fairly big, but we can expect that as we accumulate more and more events, the H0 uncertainty will reduce. And that's what's summarizing this plot. So in this plot, the upper panel is showing how many number of detection as the time goes by, so going to the right-hand side, going to the future. And the bottom panel is showing the corresponding H0 uncertainty for the given number of detections. So if you don't know what HLV is, that's fine, just going to the right hand side, better sensitivity and also larger gravitational wave network. For example, from this plot, you can see that in 4 or 5 years, we can possibly reach a 2% uncertainty in H0. And that is an interesting precision because it can possibly help us to resolve these H0 tensions. Some more details about this plot. To make this projection, we have to have a realistic distance as distance simulations, which is some pipeline we've developed over the last few years. And also, there is a peculiar velocity being considered in this study, because for those relatively less close by sources, when we try to measure the redshift, it can be contaminated by the local motions of these host galaxy relative to the cluster, relative to the Hubble flow. So some uncertainty you have to assume for those cases. So that is the range we consider. But this is a problem for the nearby sources. However, for the sources that's further away, then the distant uncertainty goes up. So it's a trade-off if either you get a larger uncertainty in distance or larger uncertainty in redshift. So in the end, we can find a certain sweet spot for where the gravitational wave sources should lie at that will give us best some H0 precision. And turns out that distance lies around 40 to 80 megaparsec. Another thing that people have been asking about this 1904, the April 25th event, the BNS event, which we did not capture any EM counterpart. But will that delay our 5%, 2% in 5 years projection? The answer is no, because in this case, the April 25th case, it is a single detector or singles plus Virgo detection, which is understandable because sometimes the detector just not being on. And that case has already been excluded in our estimation. We consider some reasonable duty cycle, which is 50%. And I just look up in 03 so far, the real duty cycle is 46 point something percent. So it is pretty a realistic estimation for our projection. So hopefully we'll still be on time. And also the last thing is that there's still a lot of uncertainty can contribute to this 2% in 5 years sounds projection. So for example, the binary neutron star merger rate is largest contribution. If we go back to this plot, you can see that there is some blurry band here. So that is corresponds to the most optimistic and most pessimistic BNS rate. And that will give you different projection. All right, so coming back to this cartoon, there is also another method that corresponds to a case that where there's no EM counterpart. So specifically, let's say binary black holes mergers case. And in that case, we call it, we can do this so-called statistical method, which means you consider all the host galaxies within the uncertainty volume provided by LIGO. So within this possible volume, there can be a lot of galaxy, and one of them will be the host galaxy. If you don't know which one they are, just combine the redshift for all of the potential host galaxy. And you can imagine for this method, first of all, you will need a fairly complete galaxy catalog, for example. So this method has already been realized for two real events, and I'm not going to go into this because I guess Maya will talk about it later in next talk. I will just mention these comparisons between the case you have EM counterpart and the case you don't. And here is a comparison. Just saying that, again, this is the H0 uncertainty as a function of time in the future. You can clearly see that the case without the EM counterpart is not competitive at all comparing to the case with EM counterpart. And this is even true for for example, you have a lot of binary black holes merger, because people have been talking about if you have a lot of binary black holes merger, we detect a lot more BBHs than BNS. So possibly the numbers will win, but in this study, we also checked that, and we find that most of the binary black holes merger, their localization volume just turned out to be too big, so there are too many galaxies inside, and most of them are just useless for the H0 measurement, and that's why even if there are a lot of them, they don't help. Okay, so and of course, in this some more details, just saying that in this study, we also consider a complete galaxy catalog, which in most of the cases not going to be true. So we are just saying that in the most conservative, well, most optimistic case, actually, for the statistical method, it will never do better than the counterpart case. So we do need the EM counterpart to do cosmology. All right, so this is another thing that's already been mentioned in the last couple of days, which is we can possibly improve the H-naught measurement precision, which is by breaking the so-called distant inclination degeneracy. So this is just a quick cartoon that describes what this kind of degeneracy is. So let's say if you're given a binary, given a binary, let's say if it's face on, which means their rotational axis is pointed to you, the amplitude, the gravitational amplitude from this kind of system will be larger than the other case, which is called edge-on binary, which means their rotational axis is parallel to your line. Orthogonal to your line of sight, which is on the right-hand side, if everything else are the same. However, if we can also push this face-on binary further away, in that case, you will obtain identical gravitational amplitude, and in that case, you cannot tell whether a source you receive is a face-on that's further away or an edge-on that's close by. And in that case, if you don't have an inclination, you don't know what's the viewing angle, or you can call it viewing angle, you can call it inclination. If you don't have that information, then there is this big contribution to your distance estimate, which will then propagate to the H-naught measurement. But let's say if now we have some constraint on the viewing angles, let's say it comes from the EM side, then we can reduce the distance uncertainty, which is plotted on the y-axis here. So you can also view this fractional distance uncertainty as H-naught uncertainty, because basically this is what contributes most to the H-naught uncertainty. Yeah, it contributes most to H-naught uncertainty. So here are 1,000 simulated binary neutron star merger event. The typical uncertainty on your distance is about 20%, but if you start to have some constraints on the viewing angle, depending on how well you constrain it, is 1 sigma uncertainty, you can push it down by, say, a factor 2 to 3. And because the H-naught uncertainty goes inversely as root n, where n is number of detection, a factor 2 to 3 improvement for each event, then that means you can reach the same H-naught uncertainty with factor 5 to 10 fewer events. So that is good news. We will need them. We will need this help from the EM side if we can. Also, as a side note, we can try to look at the viewing angles, but constrain it from the gravitational wayside. So how well can we constrain the viewing angle from the gravitational wayside? The answer is this blue curve. So this blue curve is the accumulated distribution of the 1 sigma viewing angle uncertainty if we don't have any extra information. So the median lies around, say, 17, 18 degrees. But if for the same binary neutron star merger source, you also capture the EM counterpart and you get the redshift, then you will push the uncertainty down by a factor of 3. So that will become either the orange or the green curve. So, and also, I should mention that this plot is done for Hanford-Livingston Virgo, operating at design sensitivity, but if you go to O3 or if you go to 5 detector network in the future, the difference is less than 10%. So basically, this is how well we can measure viewing angle for the entire 2G detector. Okay, so the last things I would like to talk about is this neutron star black holes merger doing cosmology. Okay, so, but yesterday we already heard that neutron star black holes merger is very difficult to emit light, but let's say it happened. So let's say they emit light and they are great candidate for doing H-naught. So first of all, neutron star black holes merger, they are more massive, so we can detect them further away, which means when we try to measure the redshift of these systems, the redshift measurement will suffer less from the peculiar motions of their, say, their host galaxies. So that's one thing that's reduced uncertainty. Another thing is that this kind of system, we can possibly break the distant inclination degeneracies for them because of two reasons. So again, we look at a comparison between neutron star black holes to binary neutron star merger. We look at their distant uncertainty, that's in the y-axis. We found that because neutron star black holes emerge at lower frequency, that's easier for LIGO-Virgo to capture the merger and ring down part. So let's say if we capture the merger and ring down part, then the merger and ring down part of the waveform, they have different dependency on the binary inclination than those from the in spiral part. And that is extra piece of independent information. And that's why we could constrain the inclination better. So just because of that reason, we already see an improvement from binary neutron star merger to neutron star black hole merger. So that's one reason, merger ring down part. Another reason is that in neutron star black hole system, it is possible that black hole can have spin. If the spinning axis if the spinning axis misaligned from the angular momentum, the total angular momentums of the system, then the system can have precession. And precession, if we observe them, then they will also reveal other modes in the gravitational waveform that have different dependency on the binary inclination. So that is, again, extra piece of information about the binary inclination. And that will help us to break this distant inclination degeneracy almost completely. So we'll move from this upper part to an almost an order of magnitude to smaller uncertainty. So that is great. And we basically find out that because this improvement is so big, even if neutron star black holes are rare, and if even if some of the system don't even emit light, as long as the universe can generate one neutron star black hole for every 10 binary neutron star mergers, we can the neutron star black hole merger can possibly be a better candidate for doing gravitational wave cosmology than binary neutron star mergers. And that is only considered the case that we see the merger ring down part. If this system also highly precessing, then in the extreme case, this ratio can go up to 1 to 50. So one neutron star black hole can beat 50 binary neutron star mergers. All right, so just before I wrap up, I have not discussed, and it is still left to be discussed in the future literature, will be like systematic errors that come from the gravitational wave side. Either it comes from the instrument or it comes from the waveform systematics. There are also, we need to consider the EM selection effect more carefully. So the basic idea for that is just that if you already know that the binary sources with certain parameters is easier or harder for you to detect, then you will need to weight this system properly so that they won't give you a bias on your H-naught measurement. So this is already being written down, but we all need to really understand the EM detection efficiency for all these kind of systems so that we can make sure we don't introduce bias when we try to do H-naught. And also, we're thinking about going beyond second generation detector or even go beyond H-naught, which is some ongoing work and we are still looking into. And I guess I will leave here at the summary page and take questions.
Thank you very much. Questions?
So, Tamir, I wanted to ask you actually about your first point about systematics. To some extent, you know, all of this, relies on, let's say you get to the point where you make a 2% measurement and somebody comes and says, how do you know that your distances are not suffering from some uncertainty in the zero-point calibration of how you measure amplitudes? I mean, what would be your validation scheme for demonstrating that those distances are actually reliable. The luminosity distances you're getting from gravitational waves are not biased in some way.
So right now, we are kind of fine for 2G because the calibration uncertainty is like 3% right now, but they are improving it. And 3% is only for single detector. If you really want to introduce a bias, you have to have both detector or even three detector. All of them have an amplitude calibration that's larger by 3%, like all of them. That will give you an like adding up they will add up and then give you a bias distance estimation. If the calibration uncertainty goes to, I mean, if the amplitude measurement goes to different directions, so the error goes to even different direction, they can possibly just cancel out. So that is one thing, that calibration uncertainty is being improved by instrumentalists. Another thing is that there are people have been talking about, which I think Reed actually have some studies about it, that we can possibly use some astrophysical sources to calibrate our distance uncertainty, which I think if Reed is around, we might want to talk about it. Reed is there.
Sure.
Yeah, back.
So yeah, the brief summary of that is, if you assume you have the true theory of gravity, like GR is right, something like that, and you're just trying to, you know, constrain the calibration of the detectors, there is an overall scale factor that is H naughts that you can't get around, but you can do relative calibration between the detectors at a not terrible level, like plus or minus 25% in amplitude. But of course, there are crazy degeneracies here. You could have a phase error that exactly mimics something like what the chirp mass does in your waveform, in which case, if that is present in all your calibration error, you know, that could then change your inference of the chirp mass, which would then change your inference of the distance, and it's a very complicated system. But if these calibration errors are persistent between multiple events, you're not going to expect the same chirp mass for every event, and then you can stack things and sort of beat down on that. So we do end up with, you know, an overall uncertainty in something like H-naught that would be shared between all detectors, but if you believe that, like, the Italian contractors who built Virgo didn't use the same tooling that the ones that built LIGO did, you might expect that those shared systematics would be different.
But I guess also check how well we can calibrate our detector with astrophysical source, and how well can we do that with?
So with 0817, it turns out to be roughly plus or minus 20% in amplitude. It's better than that in phase, probably like 15 to 20 degrees in phase. The calibration group that measures the stuff directly is doing roughly few percent level amplitude, one or few degrees in phase, so way better than this.
Will not improve in the future, the astrophysical one.
People who are interested in this, come find me in the coffee break, because I think there were other questions. But then.
I have two questions. One is a little bit of naive nature. The other one is related to the first question, but it's a bit more technical. So the naive question is, what do you mean by breaking the inclination distance degeneracy if you have a precessing system? What inclination are we discussing if the system is precessing and the orbital plane is also precessing?
So it's defined by the total angular momentum relative to your line of sight. So that is what we mean by the binary inclination.
Okay, yeah. So you're talking about the total angular momentum. Okay.
Yeah.
And the other one is you mentioned that the black hole neutron stars are essentially better systems for probing H-naught. If we assume that indeed, you know, the 7-to-1 mass ratio result from the population synthesis calculations is correct, how is LIGO right now ready to actually detect precessing binary systems at mass ratios of 7-to-1? Do we have enough coverage, essentially, of that part of the parameter space to actually make confident detections?
I'm looking at Ian.
Sorry.
Yeah, we have a few papers where we've looked into the possibility that we're able to recover processing systems. We even have a few papers exploring how we may actually search using processing waveforms as templates. So this is work that is ongoing to improve our coverage to be able to find these types of systems. In general, if you take a mass ratio of about 7, we'll probably find 90-95% of NSVHs, but they won't be the highest processing ones, so they won't be the ones that break. Basically, let us measure the distance the best. So there will be some of the most interesting systems that we potentially will miss at the moment. If they're very loud, then they'll probably be found by some of the unmodeled searches. So we're not really going to miss anything that's SNR30, probably, we hope. But we are looking at sort of some of the holes that are there in our analysis. I think that's probably a whole other talk
okay,
to
thanks.
Get more than that.
All right. So 0817 already kind of like blew this open, and the current constraints are really, really good. So, you know, your plots that show years going forward on improvement, right? Like, how many typical events do we need with counterparts, whatever you want to say, like how many of those do we need before we actually make a marked improvement from the current state of affairs?
So it's fair to say that OS17 is actually relatively good, but so in the future probably expect several worst case.
Typical, right?
Yeah, but in our projection, we already consider both the best case and the worst case, and just a combination. Still, the number is the same as what I just gave. It's like maybe with 5, 10, or maybe after 20, basically, it will follow the Gaussian, it will follow the root n scaling.
With 10 BNS, you'll get to H-naught precision of, say, 5% or something.
It's possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Okay, if not, let's thank Xin-Un again. We come back at 4 p.m. after the break.